NIKKISTRONG. And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter Jr., and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Google has agreed to make changes to its online advertising business in a settlement with the French government. The agreement, announced Monday, requires Google to pay a $268 million fine for abusing its dominant position in the online advertising market. The French Competition Authority said it had found that Google's ad management system for large publishers favored its own online ad marketplace, AdX, over competitors. AdX is a tool used by publishers to sell advertising space. French officials said AdX is built to work more effectively with the service Google Ad Manager than with other ad placement providers. Google did not dispute the findings and said it had agreed to make changes to its advertising business as part of the settlement. The company promised to improve the way its ad manager services work with competing online advertising systems. It also said it had agreed to make it easier for publishers to use its data and tools. A company statement said Google will be testing and developing these changes over the coming months before launching them widely. The head of the French Competition Authority, Isabelle De Silva, said it was the first decision in the world to center on Google's complex ad-serving system. The system uses algorithms to decide which ads users are shown. Google's ad systems had hurt competition in the online marketplace and permitted the company not only to maintain but also to increase its dominant position, De Silva said. The settlement will make it possible to reestablish a level playing field for all players and the ability for publishers to make the most of their advertising space, De Silva added. The investigation began after three media groups, U.S.-based News Corp, French newspaper group Le Figaro, and Belgium press group Rossel, launched a complaint against Google in 2019. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire welcomed the decision. He said Google systems that help its own ad technologies hurt press groups that depend heavily on online advertising income. These are serious practices, and they have been rightly sanctioned, Le Maire said. Major technology companies have been facing increasing attention in Europe and other places over their business methods. Germany also launched an investigation of Google. The German government said last week it was examining whether contracts for news publishers using a Google licensing system included unreasonable conditions. The European Union has accused Apple of blocking competition in online music sales. It also has accused Amazon of using information from independent businesses to unfairly compete against them with its own products. In addition to that, the EU is looking into Google's advertising systems and methods. I'm Brian Lynn.
Top finance officials from the G7 industrialized nations agreed on Saturday to the idea of a worldwide minimum tax for international corporations. Observers say the agreement signals coming changes to laws for taxing businesses across borders in the future. However, many details have yet to be worked out before a larger group of nations, the G20, is likely to give its support to the idea. G20 officials are expected to meet next month. Here are some of the details that have been agreed on. The G7 agreement of having a worldwide tax rate for international corporations of at least 15% now faces another test. An online meeting of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is planned for June 30th to July 1st. The OECD is based in Paris. In that meeting, a group of 139 countries will negotiate the idea with the aim of reaching agreement on additional details. Any agreement these nations reach will be studied by a meeting of G20 finance ministers who are meeting in July. Observers say if the G20 countries agree to the minimum tax, then it would likely become a worldwide rule. The idea of a worldwide minimum tax is that it gives countries the ability to tax company profits even if they are reported in countries with low tax rates. The G7 finance officials want the minimum tax to be used for individual countries. They do not appear to support using an average rate for all countries in which a business might operate. Here is an example of how the tax might work. If a U.S. company reports a profit in the British Virgin Islands, which has no corporate tax, U.S. tax officials could still tax that company's profits at a rate of 15%. G7 ministers are also discussing how to tax the biggest international companies, like Apple and Google. Those details have not been made final. However, some industries, such as the mining industry, are likely to be exempt because of the way they pay governments and make profits. Also, countries such as China want to protect low-tax special economic areas to support investment and development. The OECD estimated in October that a worldwide minimum tax would provide $100 billion in additional tax income each year for governments around the world. That is about 4% of all income tax collected around the world in one year. While that is a lot of money, it is a small amount when compared to the trillions of dollars large countries have spent because of the COVID-19 health crisis. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In the United States, restrictions are loosening and COVID-19 cases are decreasing. However, eating disorder cases are on the rise, report doctors and specialists. For people with eating disorders, the pandemic created a more dangerous situation. In lockdown, feelings of anxiety and loneliness are common. Experts warn that being alone and feeling anxious can increase the severity of eating disorders. We are absolutely seeing massive increases, said Jennifer Wilds. She is an associate psychiatry professor and director of an eating disorders program at the University of Chicago Medicine. Wilds told the Associated Press that some patients are waiting 4 to 5 months to get mental health treatment and medication. Before the pandemic, she added, wait times were usually only a few weeks. Currently, Wild's program treats about 100 patients. Before the pandemic, the number of patients was half that amount. A treatment program for eating disorders at the University of Minnesota is experiencing the same thing. Daily calls to its program from people seeking treatment have doubled. In 2019, there were about 60 calls a day. Since the pandemic began, that number is up to 130 calls a day, said Jillian Lampert. She is one of the leaders of the program. Lampert stated that increases were seen in all races and ages. She says, however, that women and girls are more commonly affected than men. Some of her patients have told Lampert that their lives feel out of control because of the pandemic. As a result, they use binge eating as a way to deal with their problems. Binge eating is a disorder in which a person often eats large amounts of food and feels unable to stop. Other people are doing the opposite of binge eating. They are taking the message, "Don't gain pandemic weight," to the extreme. They are restricting their meals to the point of anorexia. Anorexia is one of the more common eating disorders. Anorexic people restrict eating to achieve extreme weight loss. It can cause abnormally low blood pressure and organ damage. Bulimia is another eating disorder. Bulimic people eat large amounts of food and then force themselves to throw it up. Peyton Crest, an 18-year-old from Minnetonka, Minnesota, said she developed anorexia before the pandemic. She has relapsed twice since it began. When her classes moved online, she suddenly lost her support system of friends and classmates. She would spend all day alone in her room and could only think of food and her anorexic behavior. She got treatment last June, but then relapsed last September and spent almost 2 months in a treatment center. Her school recently returned to in-person classes, and she was accepted to Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. Crest says her mental health has improved greatly. Eating disorders affect at least 9% of people worldwide. They will affect nearly 30 million Americans in their lifetimes and cause about 10,000 U.S. deaths each year. These numbers come from the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders. A study of electronic medical records from about 80 U.S. hospitals found a 30% increase starting after March 2020, compared with numbers from 2019 and 2018. The study was published in April in the Epic Health Research Network Journal. The leader of the Epic study is family doctor and researcher Dr. Dave Little. He said that the COVID pandemic has given society, and in particular young people, a lot of mental health difficulties. This has been a big event that has disrupted a lot of people's lives in many ways, he said. It may be months or years before we know the true damage, Little added. But he said the information should serve as a warning to parents and healthcare providers. Talk to your kids. Talk to your patients. Ensure that eating behaviors remain healthy, Little warned. He added that the sooner you respond, the better. Here are some signs of eating disorders from the U.S. National Eating Disorders Organization. Thinking about weight, body size, and food too much. Restrictions against types of food, for example, bread or sugar. Seems uneasy eating around others. Develops strange food routines, such as chewing too much or not allowing foods to touch. Skipping meals or not eating enough at regular meals. Avoiding usual friends and social activities. Disappearing immediately after eating. Extreme change in mood or behavior. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the eighth president of the United States in 1837. Van Buren had already been working for the White House for several years. He had been the Secretary of State for President Andrew Jackson and later his vice president. Jackson asked his party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. They agreed, and Van Buren won that election easily. But he did not win the next election, or the next, or the next. In his inaugural speech in 1837, Van Buren noted that he was the first U.S. president to be born after the American Revolution. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His ancestors were Dutch. He remains the only president, so far, who did not speak English as his first language. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren predicted better times for Americans. But several days later, an economic crisis struck. The situation put the country in a depression that lasted for the rest of Van Buren's term. It was one reason the president's opponents called him Martin Van Ruin. The depression was not Van Buren's only problem. He also faced a dispute with Britain related to the border between the U.S. and Canada. The conflict nearly turned into war. Historian Joel Silby says most experts do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Silby notes, Van Buren left an important legacy that still operates today. He created the modern U.S. political system. Van Buren's political education began early. His father was a farmer and operated a hotel at a small town in New York State. Lawmakers sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended farmers who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official, and then a senator, and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with, but she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with four sons. Historian Joel Silby says, although Van Buren did not remarry, he was known as quite charming among the ladies. Van Buren had a gift for politics, that is, developing relationships and forming alliances. Historian Joel Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his work-related life and social activities separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. His ability to make friends became a powerful tool. Before Van Buren, even lawmakers from the same political party operated independently. They had their own beliefs, their own supporters, and their own allies. Van Buren brought them together. First, he identified people who followed the ideas of Thomas Jefferson, support for independent farmers and states' rights. The group had become known as the Democratic Party, although it was in many ways different from the Democratic Party of today. Van Buren organized meetings for Democrats to talk about their political beliefs. he persuaded them to support the same policies, at that time, the policies of Andrew Jackson. Sometimes, Van Buren helped people who supported Jackson's policies. He gave them government jobs. Van Buren also used a series of meetings to choose one presidential candidate for the party. If this process seems clear-cut, it was not at the time. During the election of 1824, for example, a single party had four separate candidates for president, one for each part of the country. Van Buren's system eventually gave rise to the national conventions that major U.S. parties use today to nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he saw that many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, states were giving more white males the right to vote. Women, and most African American men, were still largely prohibited from voting. Historian Joel Silby says, Van Buren wanted to bring the new voters into the Democratic Party. He decided to improve on the methods that other, smaller groups had used. Campaign events, speeches, and organized efforts to bring people to vote on Election Day. Silby explains that these efforts to persuade and energize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. In the election of 1840, Van Buren sought a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political techniques against him. Silby says the new opposition party, called the Whigs, used popular speeches and events to portray Van Buren as a failed president. Crowds shouted, "Matty Van is a used-up man." In other words, he no longer had any power or effect in government. Critics also made fun of Van Buren's fine-looking, even fussy clothes. They portrayed him as a rich, elite candidate. They compared him unfavorably to their candidate, a military hero named William Henry Harrison. Yet it was Van Buren who had come from a poor family, and Harrison from a wealthy one. Even so, Van Buren lost the election of 1840. 4 years later, Van Buren again sought the presidency. This time, even Andrew Jackson did not support him. Instead, Jackson backed a man who supported the seizure of Texas and expanding slavery, James Polk. But Van Buren did not permit those defeats to stop his political career. He ran again in the presidential election of 1848. This time, Van Buren withdrew from the Democratic Party he had helped build. He ran instead as the candidate of a new anti-slavery party called the Free Soilers. But even Van Buren's political skills could not persuade voters. He did not win a single state. After losing this final presidential election, Van Buren finally retired. He spent time with his children and grandchildren, traveled, and wrote about his life. At 79, he died of heart failure. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.